All right, welcome on to this week's Hollinger and Duncan. John actually picked the topic for this week. What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about the most underrated players in NBA history.
The most underrated players. And a reminder before we get started with that, today we are brought to you by Built Bar. Go to builtbar.com and use the promo code LOCKEDON and you'll get $10 off your first order. Once again, that's the promo code locked on, all one word, for $10 off at Built Bar, which is the protein bar that tastes like a candy bar. So much like Built Bar, a number of players throughout NBA history have been underrated. Are there any specific categories that you look at to determine whether someone is underrated or not?
Well, so this is highly subjective in the sense that we're basing it off what our evaluation is of what the player's public perception is, right? So that's a hazy marker. No matter how exact our own evaluation might be, there's still this hazy thing we're comparing it to.
Yeah. I think like, you know, all NBA teams, all-star teams, making the Hall of Fame, those are pretty good indicators of what the public perception is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. People arguing you should have been on the Dream Team, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I think a few things that I looked at, especially going back to earlier eras, players who don't put up big traditional box score stats, that definitely can lead to being underrated.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of rings above all else culture that just doesn't really consider the context of who a player had around him. And there's actually two players that I'm going to talk about that where that really applied to.
Mm-hmm.
If you're good at defense, and that's one, again, where it remains even today underrated, but particularly back in the olden times. If you're good at spacing and shooting, that's probably more the case in the last 30 years after the 3-point line really became utilized. That's one that I'd look at. Anything else that you can share there?
Yeah, if you played for Boston, LA, or New York, you're probably not going to be mentioned much on this podcast. I mean, inevitably, it's the guys in the smaller markets that tend to get less attention. Maybe with one or two exceptions.
That's definitely true. But hey, let's not jump the gun here. Overrated is probably going to be the next podcast. So
yeah,
we'll do our usual format here. We can kind of alternate between nominations and. Do you want to, at the end, we'll pick like each pick our top three most underrated players?
Yeah, sure. Okay. One thing I want to add to this, we're talking about significant players here. We're not going to spend 20 minutes arguing back and forth about Amir Johnson, right? Like we're talking about high level players, guys who are the best couple players in their teams.
Yeah, that seems to make sense to me. Although Amir Johnson probably was.
Oh, he was underrated. Just it doesn't matter. Like,
yeah. Let me tell you, Sagana Jop's contributions to the 2011 Mavs, really underrated.
You know, for a 10-day guy, Mike Wilkes was.
yeah, that would be the most underrated 10-day guy who never got another 10-day.
Yeah,
that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, niche podcast for sure.
Okay, give me your first nominee here.
My first nominee, the thing that stands out to me is actually before he even got to the NBA. This guy took Jacksonville to the NBA championship game, NCAA championship game in 1970. Jacksonville, the freaking Dolphins of the Sun Belt Conference. And then went on to the ABA, where he was kind of outside the radar a little bit because he was playing for the Kentucky Colonels for 5 years, where he had probably his best seasons. Then went to the Chicago Bulls and San Antonio Spurs and actually still was able to play for a dozen years in the NBA after the ABA folded. I'm talking about Artis Gilmore. Took an obnoxiously long time to put him in the Hall of Fame. Even though he was really a great center, kind of played in that in-between era, which I think hurt him in the NBA. The 70s kind of get swept under the rug a little bit in general. But a really high percentage player, more a defensive player, right? Block shots, rebounds, big guy, wasn't super sexy even in his prime, but very effective. Led the NBA in field goal percentage 4 years in a row. Made several all-star teams. I think he made if you count the ABA ones, he made 11. And the ABA, by the time, 75, 76, those last couple seasons, the ABA was good. So, and in fact, here's the other thing about Artis Gilmore you may not know. There were two outstanding rookies in the ABA in 71, 72. Artis Gilmore and Julius Erving. Gilmore was the one who won MVP.
Yeah, a lot of black ink on Gilmore's resume. Led his league in field goal shooting 6 times and career true shooting of 62%. He had years where he was up in the high 60s, even as high as 70. And he falls into these categories. Number one, he was in Kentucky in the ABA. Then number two, he's on Chicago teams that really just aren't doing much. He was a real defensive force too at 7'2", like outstanding defensive player when he was in position at the rim, which basically every center was at all times back in the
70s. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think as much as we might say that perimeter defense is less important than big man defense, back in those days before the 3-point line really took off, big man defense was way more important than perimeter defense.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it wasn't even close. Yeah.
So because just so much of the action is around the rim, and it's also a great defensive rebounder. Yeah, I think if he doesn't just get shunted to the Bulls in 76, 77, and just in Chicago was an absolute wasteland between their teams with Norm Van Leer and Jerry Sloan that made it to a 7-game loss in the West Finals in 1975 to Rick Barry's Warriors and Michael Jordan. I mean, the Bulls were one of the most irrelevant NBA markets during that period. Then things might have been a lot different.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. By the time he got to San Antonio, he was on the downside. So I think even then they had some good teams there. But he just, he wasn't quite the same, even though he's still good. He wasn't maybe quite the same player.
Yeah, I mean, in the NBA, I don't think he ever even made a conference finals.
Which is crazy. Did any of those Spurs, was he there too late? Because the Spurs got there with Gervin, but I think he was too late for that.
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, he didn't get there until 82, 83. And I think they had some teams like, I think they had a 7-gamer against the Bullets in 1978. The Bullets ended up winning that year in what was then the
They were West. In the Eastern yeah. Conference back in the day when they first got placed into the league. The Spurs being in the East and the Hawks once being in the West are the two craziest divisional alignment things, I think, in league annals.
Yeah, they did lose in the West Finals in 1983 to the Lakers. That was the best team that he was ever on his first year in San Antonio.
Okay.
Anything else you wanted to say on him?
Just the Jacksonville part is the thing that just kills me. Took Jacksonville to the NCAA championship game. First of all, how did he even end up there? Right? Like,
yeah.
You got this 7'2 guy, like, really, Kentucky and North Carolina kind of missed the boat on that one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It would seem so. All right. Here's my first one.
Okay.
And this player really only had about a 3-season peak before injuries took him. And then he also became much more famous later on for negative reasons that I think obscured the type of player that he was. But for 3 seasons, Gilbert Arenas was a top 10 player
in
the NBA, and really a game that was ahead of his time. Probably someone that we should have even brought up in our guys who would have been even better today. Gilbert Arenas.
Oh, he was all 3-pointers and getting to the rim.
Yeah. He was almost like that era's version of James Harden. He's taken 8 threes a game. I mean, and for comparison, I mean, that's a huge, huge number. He's not hitting a Steph Curry type of percentage, but most of these are deep off the dribble shots. He had ridiculous range too. Like I remember this 1 3 that he made. I think it was right before LeBron hit a game winning layup in that 06 series against the Cavs, which was a great series to go back and watch, by the way, that was just like, probably 30 feet behind the line. He just caught the ball in the inbounds and just pulled it from there. And then LeBron came back and hit a layup on the other end, but he was just ahead of his time in terms of his shot distribution. The numbers at that point were also fantastic. They were basically, whenever he played during those 3 seasons, so 04, 05 to 06, 07, and then it's early April of 07 when Gerald Wallace falls into his knee as he's trying to box out another player, and he's never the same after that.
Yeah, that MCL really messed him up.
Yeah.
And, going back to his prime, because I mean, obviously there was all the weird stuff with the gun thing in the locker room and everything.
Yeah.
But the best I've ever seen at getting a decent shot away just as the buzzer goes off.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you'd sit there, he'd be fiddling with the ball, and you're like, what are you doing? The clock's at 3. You're going to run out of time. And every time, he would have that thing off his fingertips at 0.7. No matter what he did, if he got all the way to the rim or if he pulled up or whatever, it was unbelievable. One of the greatest second round draft picks ever as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The first pick in the second round, I believe.
Yeah.
But yep.
And he has a rule named after him.
Yeah. For us cap dorks, it basically allows teams to match on guys who are restricted free agents with 1 or 2 years of experience more easily. Like, Golden State couldn't legally match the Wizards offer at that time. But here are the numbers. They were an average of about 11 points per 100 possessions better on offense when he was on the floor in those 3 years that he was really good, 05 to 07. And just in general, they would collapse whenever he was off the floor. And it just, like, his ability to pull up from deep off the dribble with that kind of volume. I mean, to put it in perspective, 8 threes per game. I mean, that's what Steph Curry was shooting in like 12, 13, 13, 14. Then he bumps it up. I think he actually might only have been 8 threes a game, even in his MVP year. And then he bumps it up to like 11 in 2016, which is that crazy year. But like, and he wasn't hitting at Steph Curry type of percentages, but that is just way more threes than anybody is shooting off the dribble at that time.
Yeah. And I mean, he was, like you say, he was taking them all off the dribble too. It was just pick and roll, handle the ball. It was really like, it was the precursor to James Harden's game. It really was.
And he also got to the line a ton during those times. He was really strong, really quick. And so only, and he didn't make the 2006 Olympic team again, maybe due to some personality issues, or not the Olympic team, the world championship team.
Yeah.
At that time. All right. Who's your next guy?
My next guy is my all-time favorite player. Did not come to the NBA until he was 25. Did not really have his first star season till he was 27. Was good enough to play effectively until he was 40. And was part of 4 championship teams. And I still think he's perceived as like another role guy when actually he was a pretty much star, if not superstar level player the whole time. And that's Manu Ginobili.
Yeah, it's interesting. The biggest question I have is whether he's underrated. But you think that he is.
I think he's grossly underrated. Yeah. I mean, in his prime, he was putting up per minute stats that were nearly as good as Kobe's. And I don't think anyone thought they were anywhere near the same level, just in terms of their perception.
Yeah.
He only made 2 All-Star teams.
Yeah, actually.
Third team All-NBA twice. And 1 sixth man award.
Yeah, it was just, I think just the minutes per game was the biggest reason why he was underrated, but he could certainly ramp that up in playoff situations, which was.
Yeah, you can make the argument that Popovich knew that he only had so much candle to burn with him. And so he opted for, you know, less is more, basically. So you can make that argument.
Well, and not only in terms of minutes per game. But he only got over 75 games played like 2 or 3 times in his career. He had a lot of seasons where he had some, you know, it wasn't necessarily extended absences, but especially later in his career where he's playing, you know, 60, 65 games a year, which again, I think was mostly by design for them.
Yeah. Yeah. His final full season, what you'd call, would be at age 33 in 2011. And again, it's unfortunate that he wasn't able to come to the league sooner, but he was also a little bit of a late bloomer though. I mean, he was the 57th pick in the draft. Again, we talk about great second round picks. Sheesh. Was still blossoming, over in Italy before the Spurs brought him over.
Yeah. I think if I were doing shooting guard rankings during his prime, he probably wasn't getting enough shine at that point, but behind Kobe and Dwayne Wade, I don't know if you're calling Tracy McGrady a shooting guard during that time.
Yeah, Ray Allen would probably be the other one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so he's probably, you know, your 4th or 5th best shooting guard in the league a lot of these seasons, which, I don't know. I think my only quibble is that I think he, you know, he's going to make the Hall of Fame. He gets a lot of credit for his international play as well, both on the club level and with Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's tough because, yeah, I mean, I agree with you on a per-play basis. He was awesome, but he just didn't necessarily provide that much value. You know, he averaged 25 minutes a game for his career.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, I agree with you as far as like, yeah, he's, I don't think a lot of people would have been saying that he was, you know, an all-star level of player most of his career when he probably was. So I agree with you there.
Okay.
All right. Let me see here. Let's take a quick break and I'll give you all my next one here. I have tried a number of protein bars in my life and they try to dress them up in a number of ways. They'll put chocolate around the outside or they'll put some sugar in to make it taste a little bit better. But ultimately, they kind of taste like concrete. Built Bar is going to solve that for you. That is the best tasting protein bar ever. They've got 16 flavors, 8 chocolate and nut flavors, 8 chocolate and nut free flavors. The bars are covered in 100% chocolate, so they are soft and easy to chew. These are low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber. Here's what they have in them. Their peanut butter brownie, for example, 20 grams of protein, 170 calories, 3 grams of sugar, 3 grams of net carbs. Their mint brownie, 15 grams of protein, 110 calories, 4 grams of sugar, 5 grams of net carbs. I find that eating as much protein as possible is a great way to keep my weight under control because it's more filling. So having those protein bars available when you're feeling hungry, maybe it's not quite mealtime yet. It's a great way to quell your hunger. If you work out, give your body some building blocks to help build muscle, boost your overall metabolism. A huge fan of eating just more protein in general. The way to get started with them is if you go to builtbar.com, use the promo code Locked On, that's the name of this network, Locked On, all one word, and you get $10 off your first order. So once again, that's the promo code Locked On to get $10 off at builtbar.com. This player came up last week, mm-hmm. and I think people really forget about him as well because he, due to injuries, somewhat Arenas-like, actually.
Okay.
Didn't have the longest peak in the world, but when he did, he mm-hmm. was probably the second best point guard in basketball for about a 5-year period. That's Kevin Johnson.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Just so explosive off the dribble. Probably one of the great first steps in NBA history. Just from a dead stop, could beat a defender standing right in front of him with no pick, especially going right, and there just wasn't anything the guy could do about it. He was just a blur, exploding from a stop. Like wasn't so much like he was fast, but it wasn't like his full court speed that really blew you away. It was just that ability to take off so quickly and blow by somebody and be at the rim before you could even blink.
Yeah, and then he was a very explosive finisher as well. I mean, some of these free throw rates were ridiculous. I mean, in his prime, 8 free throws per game, shooting 83% yeah. from the line. And those Phoenix teams, I mean, it was him, Hornacek, Dan Majerle. Before Barkley got there, they're winning yes. 55 games. They make it, they upset Magic's Lakers in the 90 playoffs and then end up
really should have lost to Portland either. That should have been their year.
Yeah, and you know, they had Tom Chambers on a couple of those teams too, but I think KJ was probably the best guy on those teams to me. And, you know, that's 23, 24, probably his best years. And then mm-hmm. by the first Barkley years, 92, 93, it's 49 games, and then he never plays more than 67 games again. Yeah. Only made 3 All-Star teams, amazingly enough. But mm-hmm. I think, I mean, I'm trying to think of who, you know, he definitely was better than Isaiah at that time. I mean, like the stats just aren't even close to the point where you just, Isaiah has all these other aspects to him, but you it's like you can't even begin to make the argument. Like true shooting is like 10% worse.
Yeah.
At that time.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm trying to think of who else, you know, maybe Tim Hardaway.
Was Stockton and Payton, right, were the top two.
Yeah, Payton didn't really come into his own until, you know, 93 or so. So Johnson's kind of on the downswing. But, yeah, so maybe 5 years, a little bit much, but 4 maybe and he got traded there from Cleveland, too. Imagine if he'd still been on Cleveland at that point. But
they had Mark Price, Kevin Johnson, and Terrell Brandon at the same time, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's, I think, Johnson might have been gone by the time they got Brandon.
Yeah, maybe Johnson was gone by the time they got Brandon.
Yeah, but to have all three of those guys on the team pretty close to one another. But yeah, so probably for maybe like, you know, 88 to 92, I think he's probably the second best point guard in basketball for, mm-hmm. for that period. Certainly from a statistical standpoint, at least.
Yeah, and I mean, he bounced back and made the All-Star team in 94, and even in 93, I believe it was 93. That was the year he was guarding Jordan in the finals.
Yeah, he actually did a pretty good job on Jordan. After
when they switched that matchup, that was really when Phoenix got back in the series.
Yeah, yeah, because Jordan was just blowing by Marley, and then he had to go more to the post-ups against Johnson. All right, your next one.
My next one. Okay, this is an exception to my Boston Laker New York rule from earlier. The reason this is an exception is because this guy didn't join the Celtics until he was already on the downslope. And so I think people's perception of him is based more on those years and not on the earlier part of his career with Seattle and Phoenix when he was one of the best guards in the NBA and was one of the best players on a championship team. And that is Dennis Johnson, elite defender, big factor in the Sonics winning their only championship, multiple all-star teams in Phoenix. This kind of gets forgotten again, that late 70s, early 80s era just kind of gets thrown under the rug a lot, and then went to the Celtics and was their, you know, number four option, more of a defensive player there, but was still good and good for several years, was able to play a prominent role until age 35. He's in the Hall of Fame, but I just don't think people remember him as the player he was at his peak. They remember this kind of plodding defensive guy for the Celtics, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think like he's a four-time All-Star who's in the Hall of Fame. So I mean, yeah. maybe it's you're saying just that the perception of what his game was isn't accurate. He's underrated in that way.
Yeah, I mean, he made five All-Star teams, not four. I mean, he was a Finals MVP, but you ask people, they'd be like, I don't remember him winning Finals MVP with the Celtics. Well, that's because he won it with the Sonics.
Yeah. Well, it's also worth noting too about him is Boston gets swept out of the 1983 playoffs, not by that awesome Sixers team.
By the Bucks.
In the second round, by the Bucks. And then, the Sixers take care of the Bucks in short order in the East Finals. But Boston picks him up in 83-84, and then they're right back in it. Now they're helped by the fact that Philly wasn't the same team the next year. But it looked like maybe this is going to be it for a while for Boston. You get swept in the second round in 83, and you bring in Dennis Johnson, and things change a lot. Obviously, McHale, I think him beginning to be more emphasized as well was a big part of why they took another leap.
Yeah, sure.
And Bird got better even as well.
That was one of the most, that was one of the more shocking. There were some shocking series in the 80s, actually. The Lakers lost in the first round to the Rockets in three with Moses. That they switched it to best of five after that because the league was so pissed that they lost the Lakers after just a couple games.
Yeah, well, that was the right move, I would say. So I thought you were actually going to talk about something, and we don't need to get into it too much because I talked about him a lot last week, is Kevin Garnett. When you're like, oh, he just came to the Celtics late in his career, people remember him for that way. But all of the elements are here. When you look at the terrible supporting cast that he had, I think he had maybe one all-star and one close to all-star season around him in the entirety of his time in Minnesota. He wasn't an unbelievable scorer, but he was just fantastic at every other aspect of the game. He probably has the best plus minus footprint of anyone this century.
Yeah.
He and LeBron are really the two.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, because we do have access to the play-by-play stuff at that time, I mean, to me, I think, where would you think that most people would rate Kevin Garnett all time, just in terms,
I don't think they have him in the top 10. I mean, so Kevin Garnett was actually a name I had pulled up too, and I thought so strongly of him with Minnesota that I completely forgot that he played for the Celtics too, which is crazy because that's where he won his championship, obviously, and arguably could have won the MVP that season. Because he didn't have the best stats, but his impact on that team was so profound. And it wasn't a great year for like MVP candidates. There wasn't like an overwhelming guy like Giannis this year. But I digress. Garnett is interesting to me. I think he's definitely underrated from this perspective. So there are three guys going into the Hall of Fame this year: Kobe Bryant, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett. I think if you ask casual fans, they would rank them one Kobe, two Duncan, three Garnett. And I think probably the proper rating might be the opposite. I think Garnett was the best of the three.
Yeah, I think it's splitting hairs between him and Duncan. Ultimately, I would probably have to go to with Duncan because we know that he did it in the playoffs as many times as he did. Whereas KG, I think you can say if he got there, he probably would have been that good, but we just don't know for sure. So I ultimately would probably have to go with Duncan. But yeah, I think it is close. And, I would say Kobe would probably be the third of those three for me as well. Although I think they're clearly all of those guys are probably top 15 players all time. But I think most people might think of Garnett as more of like a top 25 guy all time. And I think that.
Yeah, I think so. I think they don't realize how good he was in Minnesota because it wasn't really a national thing. He was ridiculous in his MVP year, obviously. But then Sam Cassell gets injured. They're playing guards who were like marginally better than you and me in the conference finals against the Lakers. And they ended up losing.
All right, who's your next one?
Okay, because so Garnett counts. Garnett counts as your guy. All right. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, dude. I brought him up first.
I'm gonna have to rep the locals here. Guy whose career just gets completely forgotten, even though he's a really good player, and that is Lou Hudson of the Atlanta Hawks. Big time scorer, made 6 All-Star teams in the late 60s and early 70s. And like, there's like you can find like no evidence that this guy existed other than Basketball Reference. Like, he's just not in the zeitgeist at all.
What was his game like? Cause I don't really know it that well. I was actually reading a Sports Illustrated preview of the 1968 season and I saw him with the Hawks. I was like, yeah, that guy was pretty good, right? Like, but I can't say I've ever even seen a single piece of grainy film on him.
Yeah, I mean, he was a shooter and, obviously, which wasn't quite as valued then, but that was his best skill. I mean, he was a scorer who's scorer slash shooter, right? So, you know, there's no 3-point line then. So guys are shooting closer to the basket and it's more stuff going to the rim. But guys with jump shots were still weapons. So that was the thing he did, but, he was still able to, impact the game in a lot of different ways for a guy who was who was mainly out there to shoot and score. I don't know. It you just look and like, you know, he was kind of washed by the time I really started watching basketball, but you just look at the career he had and it's like he doesn't even exist in the, like, if you ask people to rank the top 100 players, his name would never come up.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take your word for this one because I really am not. I'm proving your point.
The only film of those Hawks teams, ironically, is of Maravich.
Yeah.
He did lead the Hawks to the Western Conference Finals. How about that?
Yeah, the NBA had some interesting notions of geography. I mean, I guess because, say, they moved from St. Louis, so that's why there's.
Probably just didn't bother. It was like having the St. Louis Cardinals the Phoenix Cardinals in the NFC East because that's where they had always been.
Okay, let's quick break here.
They were actually the one seed in the West that year. I didn't know that.
What year was that?
The 69-70.
Huh. But they lost the Lakers made it to the finals so that they could so they could lose to Willis Reed. All right, let's take another quick break here, and then I'll get to my next pick. So I've told you all about Theragun before. John likes using his because he stands up at his desk all day. Legs can get a little bit sore. If you're getting into bed, you've got a little bit of tightness. It's a great way to relax a little bit. I love it, though, even more for after my workouts. I'm probably using it between 5 and 10 minutes a day, every day. I just turned 40. I got a lot of aches and pains. I do full body weight workouts over the course of a week. And there are just all these areas of my body that I just had learned to live with having soreness there or not being able to work out as hard as I wanted to or do as much weight as I wanted to because I just had soreness or it felt like I was going to pull something. And now with Theragun, I've been using it on my traps, my delts, my vastus medialis on that medial side of the knee. And it really, really helps to just restore my range of motion pain-free in a lot of areas, like my shoulders in particular. I can just move them much more freely now. I've been attacking my weight workouts the way I used to when I was younger again. It really is an awesome piece of machinery. I couldn't recommend it more highly. So feel better naturally. Treat your pain. Get back to your life. You can try Theragun risk-free for 30 days or get your money back by going to theragun.com/PER, easy to remember, /PER, since we talk about all the time here on the program. That's theragun.com/PER. And for a limited time, you can get a free charging stand with purchase, which is a $79 value. That's theragun.com/PER. This is another player. I picked one guy in the top 15 who basically had most of his prime on just an awful team that never did anything. And this guy basically was in the same circumstance. If you go back and look at the rosters of the Houston Rockets in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and Hakeem Olajuwon had almost nothing around him. They had no shooting. They didn't have many other defensive players, but he still was spearheading some fantastic defenses. And while he wasn't the absolute most efficient guy and he took a lot of bad shots, he was kind of like the Jordan of the center position.
Yeah.
Although Jordan ended up becoming even more efficient than Hakeem, but he also, there was no way to stop him when he was on other than just straight up hard double teaming. And even then, sometimes it wasn't enough. So his playoff scoring, he's one of the few guys who actually has gotten better in the playoffs over the years, even when they're losing in the first round because they don't really have anything around him at all. And then when they finally got some decent players around him, things really took off for them, even though he wasn't even necessarily, at least defensively, in his prime anymore in 94 and 95. So, I mean, I think Hakeem, where would you say most people would rank Hakeem?
I think they have him very much in the second group. Like those three guys we talked about before, I think people definitely have Hakeem behind all of them. And, you know, is he a guy who's around 20? Like, I think that's where people think of him. Like he's like with Moses.
Yeah, I think he was clearly better than Moses. And those two championships get devalued because Jordan wasn't around for the first one and then was not himself for the second one in 95. But it's still not like he had a second superstar. Drexler wasn't even at that level in
no, he 95. Was, he was not anymore. No.
So, I mean, he was a solid player, like an okay second scorer, but he was maybe like a lower end all-star by that point in time. And that was only on the second team. So
the first one, it was like, who was even their second best player? Like Otis Thorpe, Vernon Maxwell? Like, I mean, they were deep, yeah. But like they did not have high end talent.
Kenny Smith.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think most people think of Hakeem as, you know, again, in that 20 to 25 range, whereas I think of him as like top 15 clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And having a decent argument for the top 10, even just because again, he is fantastic defense. I mean, he's one of probably the five best defensive players since 1980. I think people don't quite realize that about him because you just think of him as, you know, cooking David Robinson in the post in 1995 and you just don't see the defense that he brought.
And he, because he, so the story is, for those who don't know, he started playing soccer and he was a goalie. And, then he realized he was huge and maybe should try basketball. And you know, this is when he's grown up in Nigeria too, when, you know, basketball wasn't as big a thing. He had this nimbleness in his feet that would have allowed him to play in today's game in a way a lot of these other bigs that we're talking about could not. And I'd be really interested to see what he could do defensively in the modern day.
Yeah, that would be fascinating.
Because he was actually a little undersized even for a five. I mean, he was 6'10", right? He wasn't a 7-footer like some of these other guys.
Yeah, I mean, he had just great length and explosiveness. A lot of like quick pop, especially defensively. All right, your next submission.
All right, my next submission. Well, this is an easy one because he was the cover boy on the first issue of, I'm sorry, on the first edition of Pro Basketball Prospectus. He was a Cleveland Cavalier then. He went on to play for every other NBA franchise, or almost all of them. Never really on a prominent team. Never played in playoff games, but I don't think he ever played in a conference finals, if I'm not mistaken. And that is Andre Miller.
Yeah, Miller, of course, was on that 98 team, Utah, that made it to the final game.
And exactly.
Plays 3 years in Cleveland and was really underrated. Leads the league in assists, goes to the Clippers for 1 year.
Probably had the worst year of his career there. It was terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone thought with that trade that he was, that the Clippers were going to really take off with some of the young talent they had. And it just, it didn't happen for them with him and Elton Brand on the same team. You thought it was going to be really good. Yeah. I've always been lower on him actually.
Okay.
Because just the inability to shoot, and he also wasn't really like a dominant pick and roll point guard. And so there's this idea of like everything kind of had to run through him, but was he really pushing you to a crazy high level when he had the ball? And then when he was off the ball, he couldn't really do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I was that, that's why I mean, now you were watching more closely during his prime. So are those criticisms inaccurate?
They're not. And I think that keeps him out of the, I mean, certainly that keeps him out of the pantheon, right?
Yeah.
That's why he never played in an all-star game. He's, I mean, he's Mike Conley's probably main competition for best player to never play in an all-star game. And, so there's certainly that element to it. But there was so much, I guess, to appreciate about his game and his IQ. He was probably the best post-up guard or close to it of the last two decades. Had all this footwork, the up and under shot fakes. He just had so much stuff he could go to that even though like he was never like in great shape or anything, but he just knew how to play. So he was able to play until he was 39, even though you looked at him, you're like, how is this fat guy who can't shoot going to stay in the NBA that long? And he was just so crafty, really good rebounder, was actually pretty active defensively, even though he wasn't a super athlete, was still able to be a pest just again, just from his IQ. And his teams never got to the mountaintop or close to it, but they did win. You know, it would always be like, oh, hey, that's, you know, that team's a little better than I thought, you know, when he was involved. It was always these 40 something win teams. So
one of the greatest alley-oop passers of all time, maybe the greatest alley-oop passer of all time.
It's a good point. Yeah. I think certainly he was better in transition than the half court.
Yeah. It was interesting. I mean, that age 25 season included, I mean, I remember reading, the Pro Basketball Prospectus at that time, and he had just averaged like 11 assists that year, and he never averaged more than 9 any other year.
Yeah.
That year did seem like a little bit of an outlier.
It was. I mean, I can tell you because I actually watched a lot of that Cleveland team that year, and I was probably the only person who did. An inordinate number of pin down assists.
Yeah.
For it was like Wesley Johnson, Jermaine Jones. Like they had a lot. I'm trying to remember all the guys.
Wesley Person.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. They had a lot of jump shooters on that team.
Yeah. Yeah. You're so not getting too many assists by throwing total. Wesley Johnson passes up and down.
You'd have to be a real volume assist hunter to get it that way, huh?
Yeah. That's, I don't know. I thought he was going to really take off. I mean, that was his age 25 season. And then I don't know whether things just changed for him going to the Clippers. Then he has 3 years in Denver after that. I think, was he in the Iverson trade? No, I think he played with
Iverson. It was Iverson for Chauncey Billups, I thought.
Oh, no. I'm talking about the trade that got Iverson to Denver.
Oh. Philly.
I think he might have been, actually.
He might have been. Yeah. And then, like, he was good in Philly, but they didn't have a whole lot else there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he got traded at the start of the 06-07 season. He gets traded for Iverson. I remembered Iverson as being in Denver for longer than he was, but it looks like it was only really two full years. All right, my next one. Mark Eaton, who came up a couple of times as with isolation ball and how you didn't have to guard him on offense. But the Utah Jazz in the late 80s were really more of a defensive team. And Eaton was terrible offensively. I mean, I don't know if he even, I mean, think of him as kind of like a Roy Hibbert of his day, but maybe even less offensive ability. But the guy was 7'4" and you just like couldn't score over him at the rim. And when he gets a little older and retires, they morph into being one of the best offensive teams as they go with centers that either had a little bit more stretch to him off the bench, or Ostertag would play some minutes. He could at least offensive rebound and dunk. And Eaton, you know, was not great at those things. And they did a lot of just like parking him out at the 3-point line because you had to guard him back in those days.
Yeah. Yeah. That was fun.
mean, if you look at those rosters, like, he was their defense. Like, there is no reason for them to be a great defensive team other than him. And they're, you know, a top five defense every year in the late 80s.
Crazy career, actually. His rookie year, he was 26.
Yeah, like him, Rodman. I mean, there are guys who would just, like, come into the league at 25 and, like, make an impact immediately back then.
Yeah, which, that's, like, completely inconceivable now. Two-time defensive player of the year, obviously. Made all defense 5 straight years in his best years. Yeah, I mean, he was the guy. I mean, he would probably had more standing blocks than any player. You know what I mean? Yeah, where he would just stand at the rim with verticality, and the guy would just shoot the ball into his hands without him jumping. It was insane how many of those he would get.
Yeah, him and Manute Bol are probably the all-time leaders in that. Tim Duncan had a bunch of those too, actually.
Duncan had a lot of those, yeah. Although some of those he would like tiptoe jump.
Yeah.
Whereas Eaton was genuinely just standing there. But like, I mean, 9% block rate his rookie year, like that's ridiculous, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't just blocks and that was it. Like, it showed up in the team defensive numbers as well.
Well, yeah, he wasn't taking himself out of the play going for blocks he couldn't get because he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a leaper anyway, so he wasn't going to be doing that.
Okay, who's your next one?
My next one. All right, so I don't know. Maybe this is too captain obvious, but like, what about Shaquille O'Neal?
Yeah, like we talked about him when we did our greatest seasons ever.
Yeah, I just feel like those 3 years have morphed into like Kobe's championships somehow, and like that's not how it was at all. He impacted the game as a big more than any other big at the offensive end. It's not even close in terms of how he forced the whole defense to sag in, or the rapidity which he would put fouls on guys and force them to play their second and third bigs the whole game. I mean, one of the big reasons people don't forget that game 6 against Sacramento, Shaq fouled out Vlade and Scott Pollard, and they were forced to play And did he foul out Weber too? I can't remember.
Weber was in trouble, but he had to guard him. It didn't go too well.
Yeah, they were playing Lawrence Funderburk at center, you know, in the fourth quarter of that game, because they didn't have anyone else. Shaq fouled him out, and that wasn't an uncommon thing.
He's the best offensive big man of all time.
Certainly a prime Shaq. Yeah, yeah.
I think that's pretty that amount of volume and efficiency, and you know, was a decent creator as well. Even really, really fantastic offense.
Yeah, got the between Orlando and LA, the thing that changes, he got the hang out of passing out of those double teams. And by the time he was in LA, and especially in Miami, he was much better at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people would again have Shaq kind of in the, you know, maybe 15 range, and I might have him top 10.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely top 10 for me, without a doubt.
Here's another one for you.
Okay.
He's only made famously one conference finals in his career and was not able to finish that series. But Chris Paul has an argument for the second greatest point guard of all time. I don't see any way that you could rank him lower than fourth. And that's only if you count Oscar Robertson as a point guard. I think you could say I might have Steph Curry higher than Chris Paul, mm-hmm. but Paul has a lot more longevity than Curry. Curry clearly has the higher peak to me. But Chris Paul, I mean, he's between the second and fourth best point guard of all time. I mean, I think that's like, do you have any pushback on that, or do you think that's correct?
I don't think so. I mean, so if you say Oscar's one, then Chris Paul is competing with Curry and Stockton, right?
Yeah.
Am I forgetting somebody?
Some people,
oh, I'm sorry. There's Magic. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Magic is number one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Magic might even be underrated too, by the way. I think he might be like actually a top five all-time player, but, and I think some people have him more in like the 10 range, but, I mean, Chris Paul just, he had that one ridiculous season in 2008. That was probably his best season ever from a statistical standpoint at over a 30 PER as like a 6 foot guard. It was just something that nobody had ever even come close to doing before.
Yeah.
And maybe the thought of his career is different if they end up winning that game 7 against San Antonio in the second round that year, 56 win team with, you know, really not a ton else around him that year in 08. And those Clippers teams all were really good, even though they had some pretty severe flaws on their roster.
What happened to them in 2013?
Blake Griffin sprained his ankle and they lost to an inferior team. Is that where you're going?
It's getting cold in here.
Yeah. No, that, I mean, that was actually, I mean, that's one of the great what ifs, though, right? I mean, you guys make the West Finals that year. Mm-hmm. Clippers beat you. They easily make the West Finals that year instead. And maybe the perception of them is different. But yeah, I mean, that series, correct me if I'm wrong here, Clippers win the first two.
Won the first two. Chris Paul made a shot at the buzzer, one-on-one against Tony Allen to win game two. We came out games three and four. We smoked them. And then game five, yeah, it was like right before tip off, we started hearing stuff that Blake had hurt his ankle. He played, but he didn't play particularly well. I'm trying to remember that game. I feel like Mark played really well that game, but I can't remember, all the details. But yeah, we got that game, and then it was weird. Like game six, they were spent. Like it was like Vinny, I think, knew he wasn't coming back. And like, it was a weird attitude that changed in that sixth game. Like I felt like they never had a chance in that sixth game.
Oh yeah. Y'all killed it. I think like, did Blake like get ejected like down 20 in the fourth quarter? I want to say,
Zebo and Blake, I think both did. Yeah. Yeah. Is it Zebo and Blake did not think highly of each other.
Yeah. Game five, y'all beat them, by 10 on the road. Chris Paul had 35 of the Clippers' 93 points in that game.
Wow. Wow. So, I mean, there's a bigger what if with him, though, obviously, if he doesn't hurt his hamstring in 2018, right?
Yeah. I mean, I still think Golden State could have beaten him anyway, but I mean,
they yeah, could have, yeah, and they might have, but it's certainly a what if.
Yeah. No, for sure it is.
And yeah, because the playoff stuff, I think, does hurt his perception. I mean, yeah, that series against Oklahoma City, especially.
If you actually look at like what his stats are in the playoffs, like they're awesome. I mean, he had huge, huge moments. Like that game seven on one leg in 2015 against the Spurs is one of the great playoff games of all time.
Yep. Hit the shot over Tim Duncan at the end. Yep.
So yeah, this is one where, I mean, maybe you can say that he's been around for some collapses and that he deserves the blame for that to some degree. Like 2014, that screw up in, I think it was game five, where they should have won. They were up eight with like 3 minutes to go. He turns it over trying to get a three shot foul in the backcourt on an intentional foul situation. They blow the lead, in game six the next year against the Rockets. So he definitely emotionally might have been a little bit too much for some people. And, you know, he wasn't like the guy calming everyone down necessarily in these crisis situations,
yeah,
I don't think.
Yeah. But he was actually good too, that people forget his first playoff series against the Spurs in 2008. I covered that whole series for ESPN, and he was awesome that series too. He just didn't have enough help, and they they couldn't quite do it in the seventh game, but that they could have gone to the conference finals right then too. That was one of that year he had the highest playoff PER of anyone in the league. And then the year we beat them in 2013, he did as well. 29.2 PER for those six games.
Yeah. And for those who would say that Stockton was better than him, to compare Chris Paul's playoff stats to John Stockton and get back to me.
Yeah. All right. I mean, Stockton's biggest advantage in any of these discussions is longevity, where Chris Paul, I think, is good, may end up catching him on that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. Stockton played effectively until he was 40. That's a lot to ask for. But he can get close. And also, I mean, Chris Paul got started much earlier than Stockton did. It really wasn't until he was 25 or 26 that Stockton really was like playing at an all-star level. Okay, give me, let's do like two more each year, and then we'll pick a top three.
All right. I still feel like this guy doesn't get enough respect. Won a championship, finals MVP. Really won wherever he went in the second part of his career. Took a while to get going, but man, Chauncey Billups was a good player.
Hall of Famer in your mind?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Seven straight All-Star team. I mean, he personally went to the conference finals, I think, 7 years in a row, right?
Yeah.
Cause he made six in Detroit, and that was really the turning point when they got him in Detroit. After he'd been, here comes Terrell Brandon again. He was Terrell Brandon's backup in Minnesota. And then Terrell Brandon got hurt and he played well the second half of that year. And I have one of the great T-Wolves what ifs. Why didn't they just re-sign Chauncey Billups? Good God. They had Kevin Garnett there. Like what happened there?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a feeling that they like couldn't afford him at that time.
Well, the mid-level exception. I mean, sheesh. Whoo.
I didn't say it was a correct feeling.
Hands down, the greatest mid-level exception contract of all time.
Yeah, that's true. You know what? I've said that about PJ Tucker, but I forgot about him. That's obviously much better.
Yeah. So he goes to, you know, the part people kind of forget, I think. He goes to Denver. They make it to the conference finals, really make the Lakers sweat in 09. You know, that I'm trying to make sure I'm not colliding my years here, but I believe that was the year the Lakers beat Orlando in the finals.
Yes.
That conference finals against Denver was much tougher than the than the actual finals they played against Orlando. In the middle of that series, I forget what game I was at, but I had one of their guys come up to me, one of their media guys come up to me and like, oh yeah, we're cooked. Like Denver's going to win this. You know what I mean? Like, and which was unusual because the Laker people all had this like incredible confidence. But that series, like they were worried. And it wasn't really till the second half of game, I remember now, the second half of game five that the Lakers really turned it. And then the Nuggets kept throwing away inbound passes at the end of games.
Oh, yeah. Trevor Ariza had like three pick sixes in the last 2 minutes.
Yeah, the pick sixes on inbound passes. It was like a constant thing. And there was a lot of Anthony Carter going on, too, if I remember right. But I digress. Getting back to Chauncey, I mean, he was really good and really could have. We talk about Stockton. If Chauncey doesn't tear his Achilles at 35, I mean, he had the type of game where he could have just gone on and on and on.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, also underrated because he shot a lot of free throws and he shot a lot of threes. And that was back in the time when people just looked at your regular field goal percentage.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Big time true shooting percentage guy. As a point guard, had a true shooting percentage of 60.9. In 05, 60.2 in 06, 61.9 in 08.
And these are like, isn't like now where, you know, there's a lot of guys who are high usage who have that type of true shooting. I mean, that's like very rare.
It's like inconceivable for a guard.
Yeah.
That he would to be high threes and high free throws.
Okay. I've got one more here. This is kind of cheating a little bit, but basically anyone who is on the 1980s Bucks.
You see, I thought about Sidney Moncrief. And the only reason I didn't go there was because his career was so short, but I always felt like he never got his due, that was such a good team. And he, you know, obviously he was perceived as the best defensive player in the league at the time or right there with Bobby Jones. And, but they never got, even though they were a 50 win team every year, but they were never on TV. It was Lakers, Celtics, Sixers, right? And you just never really saw them. So you just saw pictures of those uniforms.
Well, and then this will surprise people as well. What are some of the other ways of being underrated? Well, defense, obviously, especially back in the 80s. Don Nelson is their coach. Crazy as it is to think about Don Nelson today, you know, people remember him from his two tenures in Golden State, for example. He flamed out in less than a year with the Knicks. They're like a top two defense every year under Don Nelson in the 80s.
Yes.
And Moncrief was a huge part of that as well. Terry Cummings was their big scorer on offense. It wasn't that efficient, but he could create a lot of shots. Yeah. And their offenses were totally respectable. You know, they had top 10 offenses, top five in some years. I mean, the year that they get swept by the 86 Celtics, who are an unbelievable team, in the conference finals, but they were actually like had the point differential of a 62 win team that year, and they just got housed. I mean, they there just was never that one year that they could get past either Philly or Boston.
That was the problem. Yeah. They had to get past both of them in the same year. And that didn't happen. We mentioned Moncrief. The other guy we should mention in the same breath is Marcus Johnson, who had a bad injury at age 30, but had made five All-Star teams with Milwaukee and then later the Clippers. And still does TV for the Bucks, I think.
Yeah, no, he does. Yeah, old school 888, I think, is his Twitter handle. He does a nice job for them. But he, and Paul Pressey, the original point forward, was on those teams too. Also a really good defensive player.
Yeah, that's a good one. Bob Lanier.
Yeah, he was kind of nearing the end.
He was definitely close to the end then. You know, he played against Artis Gilmore in the Final Four for St. Bonaventure, their only Final Four appearance. Bob Lanier actually had an underrated career too, though.
Yeah, that's one I wasn't quite as familiar with him. Okay, give me one more here.
All right. You know, I got a couple guys I thought about. I thought about Bobby Jones, but I feel like he actually kind of got credit for what he was mostly.
Yeah.
Playing in Philadelphia, you know?
Yeah, I was probably too harsh on him, actually, when I was saying that, like, Andre Iguodala was definitely better than Bobby Jones. That probably was not actually.
Yeah, you go back and look, like, he was actually good. You know, I thought about Nate Thurmond, but it's hard because I don't have a lot to go on. I never really saw him play. I thought about Fat Lever and Sam Cassell, but you know, they weren't quite upper echelon guys, I guess.
Yeah.
But so the one guy I kind of ended up with that I still think gets a little lost, again, another 79 Sonic here, but Jack Sikma.
You've just been spending too much time with Pelton, haven't you?
It's clearly he's brainwashing me from afar.
Yeah, I remember him from late in his career when he was just pretty stiff. And
by the time he got to the Bucks, yeah, he just wasn't the same guy at all.
Yeah, but I mean, stretch big, renowned for some of his up and under post up moves.
Yep, and a step back and the perm.
That's amazing to me. There really were men used to get perms.
It was a frightening time.
Anything else you can share on him? Any like big stats about him that show up?
One of the best free throw shooting big men of all time.
Interesting.
Shot 92 one year to lead the league, 85 for his career, or 84.9. Made 7 straight all-star teams. Never made an all-NBA team. That would probably be the biggest knock. Like his peak was never super high, but was probably the second best player on that championship team. A lot of, you know, he was a big guy in that era. He didn't have to move as much, but he was a good rebounder, had defensive value, even though he wasn't a huge shot blocker. Had some pretty good assist rates for a big guy, too.
Yeah, it's so weird when you go back and look at these guys' stat lines, like, oh, first year in the league, 23 years old. It's like, where's the, and like, this guy played 13 years, but he was retired at age 35. Like, now that's like a 16-year career.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember him for his, like, getting dunked on by Jordan on the Bucks.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, so 70, from age 23 to 29, he made the All-Star team every year playing for the Sonics.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I mean, the West center position was maybe, like, it was, you know, it was him, Kareem, and, like, Alvin Adams, I guess. So, wasn't super awesome, but still.
Yeah, Moses, like, was in there a couple of those years.
But, oh, you are correct. I'm sorry, I forgot an important name.
But that's back when you could have, you can kind of see the footprints of his game. He had pretty low offensive rebounding for a center, but you could see that he was, you know, staying away from the basket a little bit more, or he would be the guy posting up rather than like off the ball fighting for rebounding position.
Yeah. He's a guy you wonder about in the modern game a little bit.
All right. Last one here for me, Reggie Miller.
Really?
Yeah. And do you think of him as like a top 50 player all time?
You know, probably not. And he might have a case. I don't know. Like, people made a big deal about him at the time, but especially the years when Indiana was good, you know, when they were playing the series against New York and everything. And I'm sorry, multiple series against them and against the Bulls and played in the finals against the Lakers. So he definitely got a lot of attention, which is why I didn't really go there. But you could argue, like, he only made 5 All-Star teams and probably should have been on it most or all of those years, right?
Yeah, I think that's where it really comes in for me. You know, if the NBA is doing, like, I don't think anybody really thought of him as a top 10 player back in his day. And,
well, he wasn't a big also. I mean, I just, like, people didn't think through, like, how the impact of his shooting could impact the rest of the court.
Well, and if you look at number one, what he did in the playoffs, where he's one of the few guys to get better in the playoffs, and they've got like very good offenses pretty much every year. You know, if you look back at their relative offensive rating, they're, you know, 3 points better than league average with, I mean, who else is on those teams again? I mean, like Detlef Schrempf, Chuck Person is on a couple of those teams. Then they've got, you know, the Davis brothers, Rick Smits and
Smits,
a revolving door at point guard. He really is just a fantastic offensive player and gets better in the playoffs, where what he was doing is really difficult to deal with. I mean, he's running off of screens. He manages to get to the foul line. He's got these leaners, the ability to combine a high free throw rate with his outside shooting. And
yeah,
pulling teams.
And he shot 90 from the line, too. Oh, yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, that guy, rooting against him in those years, I mean, you just, when he went to the line, you just, like, count that as two more, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah. The thing he never totally had was just shot creation.
Yeah.
And that, that probably kept him out of the upper echelon. It probably affected his perception because so much of his game was without the ball. So you'd just go stretches without seeing him touching the ball or dribbling, and doing stuff. But actually, like, as still a decently high volume player, was able to lead the league in true shooting percentage twice as a guard in the 90s.
Yeah.
And was over 60 every year.
I mean, he's really the first player in NBA history where he could get two guys running at him at the three-point line off the ball. And
that, you know what else he was? He was the first guy to pull up from three on the break.
Yeah.
Or to spot up on a two-on-one to flare out to the three-point line.
That's a great point. Yeah, but I'm sure Larry Brown must have just loved that.
Well, fortunately, that was already already ingrained by the time Larry got there, so he couldn't do much about it.
Yeah, but I mean, when you just look at the offensive performance of those teams, what he did in the playoffs, and just who else is on those teams. I mean, they make five conference finals from 1994 to 2000.
Yeah.
And they only made it to the finals once. But I mean, again, who is on these teams? Like, granted, the East isn't like so unbelievable there. And, you know, they only had a couple of regular season teams that were like really, you know, 55 wins or better, but they're punching above their weight in the playoffs every year. And when they did lose, they lost in like seven games.
Yeah. Knocked out Shaq in the first round, that year that they got to the East Finals, lost game seven, had the thing with Spike Lee and all that. And that was considered an upset at the time. Everyone thought Orlando was going to win that series. I think it was the 4-5.
Yeah, that would have been like Penny Hardaway's, I want to say, his rookie year. Yeah,
and then they knocked out a 57-win Hawks team in the second round.
Yeah, those
were... That was an impressive run.
Those Hawks teams were some paper tigers. Those, like, they went... I think that's the year that they traded Dominique Wilkins.
That was Danny the year Manning. They traded Dominique for Danny Manning. Yeah.
And they got the one.
They had Mookie Blaylock, Stacey Augmon, Mutombo. Yeah. I mean, like, it was a good team, but it was like, it was such a regular season team, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, give me your top three most underrated players of all time.
Wow.
I'll start with my number one. And that's
gonna be. I think you might have won me over on a couple of these.
Good.
But
I'm too stubborn, so I can't say the same. No.
Okay.
KG is probably my number one.
Yeah, I think I might have to go with you there. I still don't think the perception of him is caught up with how good he is. So I'm gonna agree with you on that one. It's tough again because we're comparing to, you know, this hazy thing of how they're perceived, but I just don't think enough people realized how good he was in that like 2000 to 2005 range in Minnesota before he ever got to Boston and just what a high level he played at for some teams that unfortunately weren't that great with one exception.
Oh, here. Sorry. I got to hijack this. I know we're running long, but. I missed him on my list. He was hidden there. I think we should talk about Steve Nash as a possibility, but this discussion of the point guards probably is incomplete without him. Yeah. I actually would probably put him above Stockton, I would say, as well. I probably would have Chris Paul higher than him, but man.
Yeah.
Like,
I would put Chris Paul higher, but it's tough. But I mean, once you add in defense, I think you have to put Chris Paul ahead of him.
I agree. That's
Stockton versus Nash is more quantity versus quality.
Yeah.
And I think kind of at the high end, you tilt toward quality and say, I'll take Nash's best years.
It's funny because I always thought that Nash's MVPs were dubious in 05 and 06. And
I definitely did at the time. And I'm still a little shaky on the second one, but he completely changed the game.
And he was on the number one offense in the NBA. For like 10 straight years.
Yeah. Yeah. Now Dirk had something to do with that too.
Absolutely. So did Stoudemire and Marion and shooting and the coaches and all that. But I mean, he is the through line there. And yeah, he didn't have as much responsibility in Dallas. I'd probably give Dirk more responsibility for what they did in Dallas than him. But in Phoenix, I would give him more credit than say Amari Stoudemire because the next year Stoudemire goes out for the whole year and they're still really, really good offensively.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think I would probably, but yeah, I'd have CP probably ahead of Nash. But yeah, I mean, that's one that's interesting. I mean, he's going to clearly be a Hall of Famer. Did he make it already? I can't remember. I think he might still have one more year to go, but
yeah.
And he won two MVPs at the time, but I think most people, even though he's winning MVPs, wouldn't have considered him to be like a top five player at any point in his career.
I think you're right about that. Yeah. Yeah.
And if you look at the team effect offensively, I think he's got a pretty good argument for that.
You know what's crazy about Nash is that he probably left money on the table too. Like if he had shot the ball more, as good a shooter as he was, I think it would have been even more valuable.
He's personally said that.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree with that.
Now, I'm not sure that he had the level of like versatility to his jumper. Like he kind of had to load up a little bit. He didn't have the quickest release in the world the way like someone like Steph does.
Yeah. He needed to get the guy moving. He needed to do a right hand dribble and get the guy moving and then he could like hop into it.
Yeah. He kind of had to like really bend his knees. Like he's a pretty exaggerated follow through. And beautiful, pure looking form, but it wasn't like it was just popping out of his hand in like 2 seconds.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I like he would have to take a couple of steps to get into you're right, and like kind of load up. But yeah, he was a really, really good player. And I think certainly to me, you know, has a pretty good argument for being in the top 40, and I don't think anybody would say that. I know my buddy Ben Taylor has him way higher. He has him at 19. I can't quite go that high.
Yeah.
But that's
Yeah. But as top 40 player, yeah, I think he definitely is.
Okay. So I interrupted here. Who's your number two?
Artis Gilmore. I just think he gets completely overlooked in every NBA history or anything. And I think he has an argument as a top 50 player. And I don't think anyone even thinks of him as on that level.
Yeah. Between the ABA and then, you know, like he wasn't a huge scorer. He did a bunch of other stuff instead. Making things happen on defense. I mean, he fits the criteria that we laid out for being underrated. He fits all of those. Like, he would be in my top three as well. He was a really, really good player for a long time.
Jacksonville, Nate. The freaking Dolphins of Jacksonville.
I go with him as number two. That's reasonable. Yeah. I mean, some of my guys were just flashes in the pan. And so I more felt like a responsibility to bring up how good they were, but if they only were really good for 3 seasons or 5 seasons, like Arenas or KJ, I can't really nominate them for this. I mean, I think Mark Eaton should be up there. Two defensive players of the year. And like, I don't think anybody today even begins to think about him.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly. Yeah. He does. Nobody taught. He didn't. The one thing I'll say is like the game that like, I don't, can he play in today's game?
No, of course not. But as far as what he was doing at that time.
Yeah. That's what makes it a little harder for me with him. You know, I'm a Ginobili stan, but I felt like you weren't coming with me for that journey.
Well, hey, it's your own list, man. Do whatever you want.
Well, I'm putting Manu on my list. How about that?
Yeah, I just can't go there because of the minutes, I think, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that Spurs team has gotten plenty of exposure. And the fact that he was part of this trilogy with Parker and Duncan. I think it is reasonable. Who would my third guy be? You'd probably go with Akeem. Akeem would probably be.
Yeah, I think that's a defensible pick. Yeah. Yeah.
Again, just because his years in the late 80s and early 90s were just totally lost. I mean, their drafting was completely terrible. They had guys get suspended for 2 years due to drugs. Ralph Sampson blew out his knees, although he was probably even overrated when he was healthy. Yeah. Like Sampson, because he hit that big shot and he was like the target of Celtics fans' ire in the finals. Like, I think a lot of people kind of think of that team as being like Sampson's team that made it to the finals in 86 when really Akeem was
That was Akeem's team.
Yeah, was by far. Yeah,
people forget the early in game six, he had 3 straight steals for dunks. Like, it was like, oh my God, what is going on here? What is this guy doing?
Yeah, Akeem, by the way, like, he had like years where he's averaging 2 steals a game.
Yeah, yeah.
In addition to like the great block numbers and the overall defense. Yeah. So Akeem would probably be my number three. So KG 1, Gilmore 2, Akeem 3. And your number three is Ginobili.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy to think about some of these guys, Hall of Famers, being underrated, but
You know what I'm noticing here? There's a lot more underrated bigs than guards. Like guards, I think people just naturally gravitate to. And it's harder for bigs.
Well, we've got a whole podcast on the most overrated players.
Yes.
Coming next week.
Yes. Very excited. Sharpening my claws as we speak.
What did you write about for The Athletic this week?
Oh, so got a couple of interesting things coming for The Athletic. I got my under the radar free agents for this summer. And then we're doing a little something on what if. So I got a really interesting what if from my time in Memphis, and I don't want to do a spoiler yet.
Okay. And for me, please give our COVID daily news a listen. If you are feel like you are have too much coronavirus news, cut back on that. Listen to our pod. Hopefully a lot of people have said that it actually helps them avoid stressing out so much to listen to it. And you just listen to that and then you go about your day. So that's kind of the thought behind it. And you can subscribe at The Athletic, theathletic.com/PER to get John's work. And we'll talk to you all next week with the most overrated players of all time. Till then.